Welcome to The Commentary. I'm Mark Bertrand. I'm a novelist and the pastor of Grace Presbyterian Church.
And I am aspiring poet and professional pencil pusher Cameron Brooks. The Commentary is a weekly conversation about vision, worship, and life at Grace.
And in this episode, Cameron, I'd like to dig into a little bit of worldview thinking. You know, every summer I teach at Worldview Academy, and I feel like I have a lot of conversations with people about worldview, but there's one particular aspect of worldview thinking that I think people aren't often aware of. And I thought this might be a way to explore that a little bit. And what I want to talk about is myths, ideas that shape the way that we think, that are so prevalent, so unexamined, that oftentimes we're not really conscious of what those things are. I think we're surrounded by unexamined assumptions that inform the way we think about the world, and really do more than that. I think some ideas are so basic that not only do they kind of shape our thought and dictate our action, but they also blind us to other possibilities. Right. Like, they're so influential. There are, of course, way too many of these things to cover all of them, but I thought maybe we could just take a handful and unpack them a little bit and try to understand how it is that these underlying assumptions, these kind of myths about our world, can influence our thinking. Yeah, if that makes sense.
That sounds great.
So I've got three myths for you, and I can explain them, what I'm getting at, and we can talk about them. But let me just give you my list first, and I'll give you kind of my titles for these things. So three myths that I think do a lot of work in shaping the way we think now, even though I'm going to argue none of these things is actually true. So there's the myth of majority rules, the myth of progress, and the myth of nature. So that's what I want to do, just talk about majority rules, progress, and nature, and why I think these are powerful ideas underneath the surface that are kind of guiding the way we think about the world.
That sounds good. Before we dive into the first one, can I ask why these three in particular? Are these... What context did these arise from? Is it the conversations you've had at Worldview, or is there something else too?
It's a good question. So yeah, it is. Mm-hmm. I'm not arguing that these are like the three most important myths to confront. Mm-hmm. I wanted to kind of find a selection that I thought were very fundamental, that if I kind of think of it like a teacher, like if you could kind of think through these things, it would help you think through other stuff as well.
Yeah.
So I kind of selected them on that basis because I think they're powerful, but also because I think once you've deconstructed them a little bit, it gives you tools to approach other myths as well.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So why don't we talk about the myth of majority rules first? Because I think this is the easiest one, and it's also maybe the most common sense of all, and yet arguably the most pervasive. Hmm. So the myth of majority rules is basically just the assumption that whatever most people believe about the world is right, that the majority is going to be right about things, that whatever the consensus is the right thing to believe. And that's true in, you know, any area of thought. So it might be true in terms of, you know, political opinion. It might be true in terms of artistic taste. It might be true in terms of, you know, science. It could be true in terms of really any area where we divide up and have differences of opinion. I think we have a very deep assumption that you should be reluctant to go against the majority whenever there are these questions of, you know, what's right and what's wrong.
Yeah.
So that's pretty basic, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
Yeah, I mean, it makes me think of the question that every mom asks her child when the child is considering doing something dumb, maybe. Well, if all of your friends are jumping off a bridge, would you jump off a bridge? It's something like that. It's getting at, I think, that very frightfully impactful reality of social pressure, basically.
Yeah.
That it's very easy for us to, at a deep level, think that something is true because other people around me, lots of other people in particular, say it's true or act like it's true.
Right.
Or don't raise any objections to it. And while you say this is a simple one, I actually think it is terrifying in a way, because it's so easy not just to go with the flow, but to actually be convinced in my mind that this thing is true because I can see all the people around me and they agree with me. And how could they all be wrong? So therefore I must be right.
Right. Right. And I think I'm going to argue that today, like in our culture, this is a more powerful myth than it would have been in the past, at least intellectually speaking, because some of the guardrails that existed in the past have been knocked over in the modern world. So I'll give you an example. If you read, this is a really delightful book, Alain de Botton's book, The Consolations of Philosophy. It's sort of like a self-help book based on the ancient philosophers. Mm. There's a chapter on Socrates that is hilarious. It has an account of the trial and death of Socrates when he drinks the hemlock, and has little charts to illustrate its point. But basically, the idea is Socrates goes on trial in a democracy. And we believe democracy is the highest form of government because in democracy, majority rules. And the democracy decides that Socrates is a corrupter of the youth and he needs to drink the poison. And so his point basically is, look, sometimes the majority is wrong, because there's no correlation between what most people think on the one hand and what's objectively true on the other. Like, just because a lot of people think it doesn't mean that that's reality. Mm-hmm. And in the case of Socrates, it's an easy point to see, right? Because we valorize Socrates and we don't remember the names of the Athenian jurors who condemned him to death, right? It's a blot on their history. He's the one who is depicted in heroic paintings, you know, in his little toga drinking his cup of hemlock. So we in the classical tradition have this idea that, you know, democracy isn't always right. I mean, the reason our nation is a republic and not a democracy is because there was this longstanding suspicion of majority rules. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, as founding fathers might have said, mob rule,
right?
Which is a very pejorative way of putting it, but it does kind of put its finger on that distinction, right? That there is an objective reality. There is something that it's good and true and beautiful. And the fact that most people don't agree that it is does not affect its status. Like, the truth doesn't become untrue if 99% of people vote and say, we don't believe it.
Right.
That makes perfect sense in the environment of the classroom. In our everyday lives and in the culture that we live in, though, that guardrail of objective reality, that guardrail of the idea that there's a truth beyond our social constructs and our power plays, that's not really the opinion of the majority any longer, right?
Yeah.
And so, like, we do now have a tendency to think that, you know, essentially all values are just power plays. They're all just the will of the majority. And that whatever the majority wills is, you know, quote unquote, right. And that you can then change what is right by changing the views of the majority.
Yeah.
Probably the best example in our culture would be opinion polls. You know, I'm old enough to remember when there were politicians who turned up their noses at the idea of opinion polling, because of course they were just going to do what's right. They weren't going to just, you know, see which way the wind was blowing and then go in the direction that the majority said they wanted in this moment, because the majority is going to change its mind next week. Mm. Now, I think you would be perceived as crazy if you didn't pay attention to those polling numbers. And a lot of our coverage of policy is essentially just coverage of polling around policy. It's shocking how little like content of laws that are being discussed is covered. Mm-hmm. It's all coverage about what people think about it and what most people think about this or that. So again, we know in theory that the majority doesn't rule, that might doesn't make right, that just because most people think something, that doesn't make it true. That's the part they say is easy. In practice, I think, you know, we've always been this way as human beings, but I think now more than ever, it's easy to fall into this way of thinking. Mm-hmm. That you want to be on the side of the consensus, that you want to believe what most people believe. Right. And you don't want to be the outlier. You don't want to be the person who questions the orthodoxy. So that there's an interesting tension, I guess, between this majority rules idea and another myth, not one of my three, but what I would call the myth of the individual. And I think kind of in American ideas of ourselves, there is this idea of the individual with a capital I, yeah, and the bravery of being yourself and being unique
and self-made man.
Exactly. And, mm-hmm, and maybe the 21st century version is, you know, that you're a special snowflake or self-inventor, you know, mm-hmm, that there is no given, no givenness to who you are, that everything about you is yours to sort of fashion. That's another myth, when the reality, as you can see, is that most of us align ourselves with tribes and seek to think in majoritarian ways. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the way people think about things over time, you see that as those sort of groupings and polling numbers change, people's minds change. They act as if they've always believed what they believe, but they're kind of following that consensus. Mm-hmm. And again, the point of saying this is just to push back on the idea that just because the majority of people think something doesn't mean it's actually true. Yep. So that if you care about what's actually true, you will have to develop some resistance, right? Some consciousness, mm-hmm, and some resistance to that kind of groupthink.
Yeah. I think this could be a whole nother discussion, but you just put your finger on something that I think about a lot, which is, I don't know if we value the truth like we should, such that I might have a hunch that something I believe could be wrong. I'm not totally sure. I don't have time to look into it, but pretty much everybody I know and like believes this.
Yeah.
So I'm going to go with it, mm-hmm, and just throw up my hands, and I'm not really sure if it's true or I don't care. And so the question of why should you care about the truth over the opinions of everyone else is a question that is worth considering. Maybe we'll come back to that sometime, but I remember reading a Nietzsche way back in the day, you know, it was Nietzsche who basically said, like, why care about the truth? Why would you value the truth over illusion? Mm-hmm. And it's actually it's a good philosophical question. When I look at our society today, I think it's worth asking again. Like, I personally believe, and I know many Christians do, that the truth absolutely matters for all kinds of reasons. But pulling out those reasons could go a long way in helping people identify, oh, I'm just going with groupthink, or I'm just doing what my friends do, and I need to care about the truth, not just.
Exactly. And you know, maybe just starting with the idea that there is such a thing,
yeah,
as the truth, yeah, you know, and that I'm not saying that you should just be skeptical of everything everyone ever says, you know, and like if you know, 51% of people believe this, I refuse to believe it because I do not want to be in the majority. Right. Yeah. You know, I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that, that it's okay to question what the majority assumes to be true and to ask yourself why, like on what basis is this the case? I'm not saying the majority is never right. I'm just saying the fact that the majority feels this way doesn't make it right.
Yeah.
That's the distinction. And I think it's an important thing for Christian faithfulness, because, you know, in our day and age, we are increasingly a minority. And if you're going to believe what the majority of people believe, it's not going to be Christianity. Mm-hmm. But even in the past, when the majority of people paid lip service to Christianity, I think there was still value in not believing in Christianity just because it's what most people believed.
Right.
Right, that it's still good to believe in what's true because it's true, not because it's what's popular.
Yeah,
and I mean, not to belabor the point, but I mean that's another thing as writers, I think we can both relate to that there's often that assumption that, you know, whatever is most popular is best. You know, that the best books are the most popular ones, mm-hmm. you know, the one that sells the most copies must be the best written, that sort of thing. And anyone who's ever spent any time, you know, in creative pursuits understands that there is often a big gap between quality and popularity. Mm-hmm. And if you've experienced that, I'm just saying that's true in a larger sense as well.
Yeah.
Right. In what we think about the world, there's a huge distance between what's popular and what's real.
Yeah.
So that's one myth.
Okay. Yeah. What's number two?
Yeah. So the second myth, and this one is a little bit harder, I think. It's the myth of progress. And it's the idea that a lot of people have now, I'll say the majority of people, that things just get better and better, that we are on a sort of march of progress, that history is moving in a direction, kind of an upward trend, that everything that went before us is worse than where we're at now, but what's coming will be even better than what we're at now. Hmm. So in different parts of history, people have had very like naive beliefs in progress and, you know, kind of thinking everything's going to be better around the future. I think about the sort of atomic age, you know, I think in the 1950s, after the discovery of nuclear power, there's this bizarre optimism that we're all going to live in these sort of utopian futuristic societies. And we still have a vestige of that when it comes to our reverence for technology as the solution to whatever problems we face. You know, I think that a lot of us believe that our current challenges are most likely to be addressed in Silicon Valley, that some disruptive tech entrepreneur is more likely to fix what's wrong with us than a politician or you know, a quote-unquote thinker. Mm-hmm. And that, too, is kind of a vestige of this myth of progress. Now, the reason I say that I think it's difficult is that it's undeniable that there are a lot of areas, you know, in modern life where we see progress. I'm one of those people that I'm like, I like air conditioning. I like technology. I like all the things that we have. The fact that people, at least in North America, on average, live lives of unimaginable luxury that, you know, pharaohs couldn't have conceived mm-hmm. of. That's incredible, you know, and that does feel like progress. You know, human lifespans increasing yeah. over time, things like that, medicine getting better, all of that. Yes. It's not that nothing has ever gotten better. It's just that things also get worse, that you can move in both directions, and that you have to sometimes recognize that if you've taken a wrong turn, the best thing to do is to retrace your steps.
Yeah.
And so there are some areas in life, I think, where we are better off than we used to be. And there are other areas where it would be good for us if we could retrace our steps and take a different path. But that's a really hard case to make these days when so many people believe everything is better than it's ever been and it's only getting better.
Yeah, to be sure. So when you say better for us, mm-hmm. who's the us there?
That's a great question. That is a great question. You know, like I said recently in a sermon that Christian faithfulness in our culture is more difficult than it was in the past. And, you know, that's one of those statements is like, well, that certainly needs some contextualization because it kind of depends on, you know, where you were in the past. Yeah. You know, I'm imagining that there were probably some Southern abolitionists circa 1850 who would say, I'm finding Christian faithfulness really difficult in my culture and would love to live in your 21st century. Right. So these things are contextual, mm-hmm. you know, and, but that's kind of the point, right? That, even today in the quote unquote modern world, there is actually a lot of diversity in how people live and what they think about the world and that sort of thing. We're not all on the same page the way we often assume that we are. So yeah, there's some progress, there's some regress and sometimes, you know, maybe lateral movements that are hard to say mm-hmm. one way or the other, but it's not just a simple march of progress. And so we've got to think in more nuanced ways, I guess, about specifically our relationship to the past. Yeah. And I would say that's the key, because as long as we believe in this myth of progress, then the wisdom of the past does not have much to teach us. And you find people today with shockingly condescending mm-hmm. views of like the thoughts of the past, the thinkers of the past, the ideas people once believed, as if, you know, everyone before 1997 was a primitive cave dwelling, you know, moron. Yeah. That goes hand in hand, I think, with sort of our modern lack of consciousness of the past. And to the extent that we talk about history or do history, oftentimes we do history in very revisionist ways that can give us misleading impressions about what the past was like, what people actually believed, how they actually lived their lives, that sort of thing. Again, all of that, I think, tends to congratulate us in the present for being as progressive as we are.
Right.
And so it's a myth that's powerful in the sense that it's constantly reassuring us that how we are is the best way to be. And those people from the past have nothing to teach us.
Yeah. Yeah. I think maybe the hardest areas of progress let me back up. I think when you look at science, for example, it's mm-hmm. maybe the easiest example. We have so many advances in science to be thankful for, and you mentioned some of them. And we get to the point where we start to think whatever the next thing is, it must be good because look at all this good that it's done so far. But over the last 50 years, at least, Christians and others have been talking about this problem of scientism, mm-hmm. where science becomes so good, apparently, that it becomes the complete explanation for all things. And then suddenly we don't need some explanations that people of the past used to rely on, for instance, God,
right.
or certain levels of causation.
Right.
We can explain things in terms of scientific causation or whatever, but we don't need those old ways of thinking. And there are some hugely problematic consequences of that line of thinking. So obviously Christians can't go along with it if you conclude that God doesn't need to exist anymore, because look at science. Science explains it all. But I was also thinking about a more recent example in my personal life. where my wife and I have been getting into some like fringe views of, or different perspectives on food and nutrition, mm-hmm. and even health, how you think about your own health.
Yeah.
And there are science once again has a, you know, an abundance of opinions for you about how you should eat or what you should do with your body and what's going to perfect your body. And if you believe in some outdated thing that they believed even 50 years ago, then you're twisted. So,
right.
There are so many examples, but,
and if you think about those outdated concepts, you mentioned the idea of God. And obviously as Christians, that's one we're like, well, no,
yeah.
But what about the idea of a human being, mm-hmm. or human nature, let's say? I remember, you know, in the 1990s when people were, you know, doing worldview conversations, they would talk a lot about transhumanism. And I remember the film Gattaca. I don't know if you've seen that, but, yeah. But Gattaca was always the one that people would bring up because it imagined this future where the children were sort of genetically concocted, and you know, you basically didn't, it wasn't exactly eugenics, but mm-hmm. but you had sort of the ability to tailor your children and avoid, you know, quote unquote natural flaws that they would have. And so I remember a lot of those conversations, but they also seemed a little bit abstract, you know, because there weren't many people thinking, well, if I had the ability to go back and you know, mess around with my genes and add a few inches to my height and make myself, you know, one of these high metabolism, naturally fit people, I think I would just go ahead and do it, right? It all seemed a little abstract and frankly consumeristic. And now we live in an age where a lot of people really don't have any sort of sense that there is a thing that is human nature. There isn't like a givenness to what it means to be human, and that's all up for grabs. And if you sound the, not even the alarm bell, but just like, hey, maybe we should not move so quickly, that's seen as a very, you know, regressive sort of reactionary response. Mm-hmm. What used to be common sense, what is literally the theme of all science fiction up until recently, that just because we can do something doesn't mean we should. Now to question whether we should just seems inconceivable. And, you know, I don't want to make it seem as if all of these issues were as simple as just saying, you know, we'll just revert back to how people used to think. As someone recently was pointing out, a Christian theologian, there's a kind of a conflicted feeling in the sense that, you know, we're against death. You know, we believe death is a consequence of sin. So if some scientist comes along and says, I have the formula now that will, you know, end death, mm-hmm. it's like, it's hard to be opposed to it.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it feels like this is the setup to something terrible, you know, that I want to be skeptical about this. And that's kind of what I'm saying, that in this case, like if in the first case, what we need to do is be a little more, like conscious that there could be a truth that is outside that majority consensus. I think in this case, the lesson is there could be some wisdom from the past, past experience that might guide us in how we proceed into the future. Not that we want to hate the idea of progress, but I think we need to recognize that not everything that happens is good just because it's new.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Yeah. That's a helpful way of putting it.
So my last myth is the myth of nature. And this is one where we touched on it a little bit talking about human nature, but I think this is specifically something for Christians. I think, you know, anyone, whatever they believe, would benefit from deconstructing that myth of majority rules or the myth of progress. But the myth of nature, this is tied to a nuance of Christian theology that in some way sets Christianity apart from other ways of thinking. So the myth of nature is really like the idea that what is natural is what is good. So that nature equals good. If something happens naturally, then it is the right thing to happen. If you're born a certain way, then you are that way. It can't be bad because that's how you were born. That's the idea. Or if this is the way things happen in nature, then it must be okay. Now, none of us are fully on board with that way of thinking, right? We've experimented with it. I always think of the example of social Darwinism, right? When Darwin first propagates his theories, kind of in the wave of that, there are people, and this happens all the time with science, with psychology, the popularizers, you know, the people who take the ideas out of the laboratory and into the world of, you know, social relations. And so people started thinking about nature differently and thought, well, if there is no God, if everything just kind of evolved naturalistically, then whatever is in nature is the way things are made to be. This is how it's supposed to be, even though we have traditionally seen some of the ways of nature as bad, like the that red and tooth and claw view of nature.
Survival of the fittest.
Right. And so survival of the fittest becomes a virtue in that context where people are saying to themselves, okay, this is how it works in nature, therefore it must be moral. Morality should be based on how nature works. That led to kind of a wake-up call, because as it was pushed to consistency, human beings start doing some pretty horrible things, and we recoil in revulsion and say, well, that can't be right. And so there's an inconsistency that we have where there's certain aspects of nature where we wouldn't say, well, that's right. You know, if lions go around eating baby pandas, I don't think lions eat baby pandas, but just the idea, like, we don't want that. Yeah. That's not the kind of world we want. But then we're constantly justifying and rationalizing our own actions on the basis, well, this is my nature.
Yeah.
This is the way I am. This is how God made me, things like that. So that's the idea, equating nature with what is good. And the nuance that Christianity brings is that Christianity believes that because of sin, nature itself has been altered. So nature has been affected, has been corrupted by sin. So we are what we are by nature, but our nature is not what it was made to be any longer. And so what that means is, for Christians, there isn't a correlation between what is natural and what is good. Ironically, what is natural can be not good. That what is natural can be the worst thing possible, because human nature is corrupted by sin. Like, that's the problem. That's the doctrine of original sin concerns the transmission of this corrupted, fallen nature. And in Christianity, we say, like, that is the human problem.
This is fascinating for me. When I was in seminary, I was really interested in the discussion of natural law. And this is a field of study, as you know, where both philosophers and theologians are trying to get at a system of morals without access to divine revelation, but just to, as you would expect, to nature. And that it can mean all kinds of different things, but there are certainly people who think humans on their own have enough moral intuition to know what's right and wrong. And therefore, as scripture says, the law is written on our hearts. Now, there's a long history in the Catholic Church of affirming that kind of a doctrine. And then there's a long history in different Protestant strands, for example, the Reformed Church, saying, well, yes, like, we're created in God's image, and by nature we can know some things about right and wrong, but we're also fallen, and that fallenness makes all the difference. And so I remember hearing that conversation all the time, where In fact, Calvin himself, I remember reading, says some things like, yes, you as a human being, you're still stamped with the image of God, mm-hmm. and that never changes. But that image is so tainted by sin that basically all that's left of your moral intuition is enough to condemn you before God. You know?
Yeah.
So you have a sense of right and wrong, and you know that you've broken the law. So that's where that discussion gets really interesting for me. But
I think, there's obviously a good basis for thinking in terms of, natural law mm-hmm. theologically, because in Christian theology, we talk about revelation under two headings, right? We have general and special revelation. So special revelation is scripture, but general revelation is God revealing himself in creation and, yeah. and what he's made, and that's nature. Mm-hmm. So we can learn things about God by studying nature, and obviously there we can learn things about nature yeah. by studying nature as well. And so I think the project of natural law or natural theology mm-hmm. is to pursue that idea, like what is revealed in general revelation. Mm-hmm. Where those differences that you allude to come in is the differences in accounting for the effects of sin. Right, because nature is not pure or pristine, we have to take into account the ways in which that general revelation, or at least the creation that reveals that general revelation, has been tainted and corrupted by sin. And so there is in the Protestant tradition also a tradition of natural law thinking, but it does try to also do justice to the fallenness of human beings. And so it's not illegitimate
yeah.
to talk about nature. It's not illegitimate to talk about human nature. Mm-hmm. I think what's important is to recognize that just because something is true in nature doesn't make it good. That it can be good. It can be an alloy of good and bad. And so the complexity is what's important, right? That something being natural does not equate it with good any more than something being held by the majority makes it right.
Yeah.
That's the idea. That if you've got to question those kind of simple connections,
yeah.
if that makes sense.
I'm trying to think of another example where people often equate something natural with goodness. Mm-hmm. Do you have any on mind?
I'm brainstorming right now. I think we do it constantly with sexual desire. Oh. We do it constantly with, honestly, with any inclination of the self.
Yeah. On like personality traits or the Enneagram tests.
Well,
no yes. offense to those.
I mean, how many people excuse their bad manners by saying, well, this is the way I am.
Yeah. I'm just a 4-3.
Right.
4-wing 3.
Yes.
So that explains it all.
Yes. Yeah. It's true. You know, yeah. that's oftentimes that tracing the origin of the behavior to something in one's nature or personality or whatever excuses the behavior yeah. in that way of thinking. And that I think would be an example of equating nature with goodness, yeah. you know, maybe a more innocuous one, but certainly just as annoying
yeah.
in everyday life.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. That's helpful.
Yeah. I think, you know, if you think about it, you could probably come up with a lot of other myths like this, underlying assumptions that we tend to make that aren't actually true, but we generally act as if they are. I'm not saying all of them are utterly destructive and, that you've got to stamp out every example of wrong think in your mind. But if you think about these things and then ask yourself like how commonly they recur in our cultural conversations, I think you do begin to see how, you know, bad ideas or let's say untested assumptions at that foundational level can multiply all sorts of, you know, inconsistent and sometimes self-destructive ways of thinking. And as Christians in particular, who are trying to think Christ's thoughts after him, who are trying to be conformed to his image, who are trying to not just go with the way of the world, being conscious of these habits of thought can help us as we try to, you know, navigate around those influences.
And doing it together, right? Hopefully.
Yeah. And I think that's a great point that, again, that myth of the individual, you know, everybody wants to be the lone thinker who's standing up against everyone. Yeah,
the Socrates.
Yeah. But the reality is not that you need to find, you know, a little minority to make your majority and then believe whatever they believe, but that sometimes a community that protects the value of asking questions and thinking through things can be all the difference, can make all the difference when it comes to, you know, liberating yourself from these habits of thought.
Well, thanks, Pastor Mark. This is really handy, and I'm grateful to be at a church like Grace and a community where I know that that's true.
Well, thanks for listening to the commentary. We hope you've enjoyed this episode.
You can rate us on your favorite podcast app and share episodes with your friends on social media. You can subscribe to the commentary on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher.
And you can find out more about us online and check out our other podcasts by visiting us at graceforsiouxfalls.org.